This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News.
Workers at Umatilla Chemical Depot finished destroying the nation's supply of 500-pound nerve agent bombs on Friday, shortly before 85-mile winds shut down the chemical weapons incinerator.
In Washington State, the King County Council voted today to switch in an all-male in voting system.
And Osama bin Laden says Zacharias Moussaoui is the only person convicted in the U.S. for September 11 attacks, had nothing to do with it.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,456 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 42,216 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2006. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Josonia Watson. Workers at Umatilla Chemical Depot finished destroying the nation's supply of 500-pound nerve agent bombs on Friday, shortly before storms shut down the chemical weapons incinerator. The depot near Hermiston had 27 of the MK-94 bombs. Other sites already have destroyed the rest of the nation's stockpile. Friday afternoon, storms with winds gusting up to 85 miles an hour hit the site, knocking out power and causing minor damage to building, including an equipment shed and a security building. Winds lifted a gazebo that overlooks the incinerator off its foundation, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, depot spokesman Jim Hackett said, except there weren't any feet showing. A generator at the incinerator overheated, leaving the plant without backup power for 45 minutes, and there were unconfirmed reports of a tornado at the depot. Most of the power has been restored, Hackett said Monday, but not everything will be back to normal until later this week.
The Portland area shattered a decade-old 24-hour rainfall record for a period ending yesterday, according to meteorologists who predicted the puddle-stomping weather would persist until at least the end of the week. From Sunday to Monday, the Portland area surpassed a 24-hour rainfall record set during the 1996 flood season. 74 hundredths of an inch of rain fell from 5 a.m. Sunday to 5 a.m. Monday, he said, compared with the old record, 44 hundredths of an inch in a 24-hour period.
A Jacksonville, Florida company has bought 293,000 acres of timber that once belonged to Crown Pacific Partners. It's one of Oregon's largest timber sales of the last decade. Crown Pacific Partners was the fast-growing timber company for much of the 90s. It went bankrupt 3 years ago. Most of the timberland is located south of Bend along highways 20 and 97. Terms of the sale were not disclosed. Company's chief executive, William Foley, said in a news release that the company would evaluate all 26 parcels within the tree farm for their potential for their timber harvesting, developing, and conservation.
The legal battle over the cleanup of the new Carissa shipwreck was settled today for $22.1 million. However, the actual removal of the wreck still must be approved by the state's Legislative Emergency Board. The Oregon State Land Board, headed by Governor Ted Kulikowski, voted unanimously to end the legal battle over removing the remaining portion of the shipwreck from a bench near Coos Bay. The 660-foot wood chip freighter ran aground 7 years ago. Efforts to free it and attempts to burn off its engine fuel broke the ship in half, spilling fuel oil that contaminated the bay and its oyster beds. The bow was eventually towed to sea and shuttled with a torpedo from a Navy submarine. But remains of the stern are stuck in the sand at a state beach. A Coos County jury found the ship owners guilty of negligent trespass and awarded the state $25 million. But the money was placed in escrow pending appeal by Green Atlas Shipping and has accrued $2.1 million in interest, boosting the total to $27.1 million.
Apple Computer Inc. and Nike said today that they have teamed up to create a new wireless device that links a running shoe with a digital music player. Nike is Oregon's only Fortune 500 company based in sprawling campus near Beaverton. The Nike Plus iPod sports kit costs $29, but must be worn with a special $100 Nike shoe. It is designed to gather information on time, distance, pace, and calories burned, and then send the information to an iPod Nano. The Nike Corporation says it plans to introduce an entire line of shoes designed to work with iPods later this year. The companies announced the new partnership in New York, where Apple is unveiling its latest retail store.
This week's planned vote of confidence in the dean of Oregon State University's College of Forestry has been delayed. The dean has been implicated in an academic censorship issue linked to a congressional vote on post-fire logging. After a three-hour meeting on Monday, a panel of faculty members decided that the time wasn't right to measure their colleagues' support of Dean Hal Salwazer. Controversy has surrounded the college since January when some professors tried to interfere with publication of a salvage logging study led by graduate student Daniel Donato. The study was published in Science, a leading peer-reviewed journal. Salwazer had appointed the panel after the blow-up over the Donato study. Panel members last week produced a report charging the dean with poor judgment in his handling of the matter. Salwazer also erred in advocating a salvage logging bill, the panel found, because the university prohibits taking sides in policy debates. Salwazer violated Oregon State's policies by lending college support to legislation advanced by Representative Greg Walden, Oregon, that would speed logging of burned forests, according to the preliminary findings of the panel members. The vote on Salwazer has been postponed to the near future and is expected to be held before Oregon State's June 18th commencement.
A panel considering ways to improve the Oregon legislature says the House and Senate would work better without party labels. The 30-member public commission on the Oregon legislature endorsed the idea of nonpartisan elections by an 18-2 vote. 10 members of the panel did not attend. The panel last month endorsed holding legislative sessions every year instead of every other year. It also voted in favor of open primaries. That would let voters select candidates regardless of party affiliation. Voters may decide the merits of an open primary if a proposed initiative qualifies for the November 7th general election. Under current rules, only voters registered with a political party can choose party nominees. That means independent voters have no say in who will appear on the November ballot.
A former Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy was sentenced today for armed robbery and other charges. David Verbus told a judge that an addiction to pain medication led him to commit the crimes. Verbus admitted to robbing two pharmacies, a bank, and a quick cash outlet late last year. He was charged in federal court with stealing about $5,000 worth of cash and drugs, including hundreds of tablets of the painkillers OxyContin and morphine. Verbus is the father of two teenagers. In a plea agreement, the prosecution is recommending 15 years in prison. Verbus resigned from the sheriff's office in January.
Washington Governor Christian Gregoire will host Mexican President Vicente Fox on his visit to the state. They will tour a Yakima orchard tomorrow and then go to Seattle for meetings on Thursday with business leaders. The visit highlights how Washington agriculture depends on migrant farm workers. The apple crop needs about 40,000 workers, and State Apple Commission President Dave Carlson says there are not enough resident workers willing to get the job done. 60% of the farm workers in Washington are immigrants. They hand harvest fruits industry in Washington is worth $1.6 billion a year in sales. Washington State and Mexico have business ties that extend beyond migrant farm workers. Boeing has suppliers in Mexico and hopes for a big share of the 370 new airliners it will need in the next 20 years. Starbucks buys coffee beans from Mexico and has 83 shops there. Alaska Airlines flies to 9 Mexican cities, and Costco has 28 stores in Mexico. Mexico is one of the top 15 markets for Microsoft.
An anti-immigrant group called Protect Washington Now plans to demonstrate at Yakima tomorrow when Mexican President Vicente Fox arrives. Organizer Bob Baker of Mercer Island says he hopes to send a message to Fox that he's exploiting his own people. Baker estimates more than 100 demonstrators might show up. Protect Washington Now is sponsoring Initiative 946 that would ban public aid for illegal immigrants and needs 224,000 signatures by July 7th to make the November ballot.
In Washington State, the King County Council voted today to switch to an all-mail-in voting system. The council indicated its approval yesterday for a mail ballot on a 5-3 vote, with Democrats voting for the change and Republicans against. King County has more than 1 million registered voters, and about two-thirds already vote by absentee ballots. The all-postal system would allow the county to close more than 500 polling places and eliminate the need for more than 4,000 temporary workers. The county may set up regional voting centers for the disabled or for voters to drop off ballots in person. The switch will cost $1.8 million. Part of the money would be spent on voter education and having older voters update their signature cards. 34 of Washington's 39 counties already vote by mail. The first all-mail election in King County would be the primary in August of next year.
The Seattle City Council decided today that a park should be renamed in memory of rock and roll legend Jimi Hendrix. Council member Gene Godden says the tribute to one of Seattle's most famous native sons is long overdue. The final decision on the name of the park, which is called the Coleman School Lot, is in the hands of Park Superintendent Ken Bounds. The resolution encourages him to name the park in Hendrix's honor. The resolution also calls for city assistance to relocate a bronze statue of Hendrix, currently on Broadway in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood, to the park. Hendrix grew up in Seattle's Central District, where he taught himself to play the guitar. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1992.
A political activist was arrested at the Port of Olympia attempting to lock the gates, apparently as a protest against the movement of Stryker vehicles in Iraq. 37-year-old Andrew C. Hendricks was arrested on a burglary charge earlier today after struggling with a security guard. Thurston County Sheriff's Deputy Dan Kimball says Hendricks placed a bicycle lock on one of the gates and was attempting to close a second gate when he was stopped. Stryker vehicles and other equipment from Fort Lewis are shipped through the port. Hendricks operates a website called Olympia Cop Watch.
Court-martial proceedings have begun for an Army sergeant accused of using military dogs to threaten detainees at Abu Ghraib. The trial of Sergeant Santos Cardona may expose whomever within the Pentagon's change of command ordered soldiers to abuse and torture detainees at the Iraqi prison. For the first time, Major General Jeffrey Miller is expected to testify about what happened at the prison. Until now, Miller has refused to publicly speak about his role overseeing interrogations at Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo. Meanwhile, it has now been revealed that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld directly communicated with Miller and other senior defense officials by video teleconference about interrogation matters in November and December of 2003. Lawyers for Sergeant Cardona are attempting to obtain copies of these video conferences to use as their defense.
The United States is riding roughshod over human rights by outsourcing key anti-terror work in Iraq to private contractors who operate beyond Iraqi law and outside the military chain of command, Amnesty International said today. It called for tighter rules on the use of contractors in a statement released with its 2006 annual report detailing human rights violations in 150 countries around the world. The rights watchdog said contracting for military detention, security, and intelligence operations have fueled violations. Few aspects of the multi-billion dollar U.S. contracting effort in Iraq have been disclosed. A report by the U.S. Government Accounting Office last year said monitoring of civilian contractors in Iraq was so poor there was no way to determine how many contractors were working on U.S.-related security and reconstruction projects, or how many have been killed.
San Francisco school officials are considering a measure that would ban the military's junior ROTC program from city schools. School board members will introduce a resolution tonight that would cut the program because of the military's don't ask, don't tell rule. The resolution wouldn't come to a final vote until late next month. If eventually passed, it would phase out junior ROTC by the 2000-2008 school year. There are currently more than 1,600 students enrolled in the program in 7 San Francisco public high schools.
Telecom giant Verizon is refusing to confirm or deny participation in the illegal National Security Agency wiretapping program, as citizens in Maine urged the state's Public Utilities Commission to investigate whether the company handed over its phone records. Verizon argues that the commission lacks the authority to investigate a complaint that the telephone company was involved in the NSA program. The company further claimed such information is protected by the state secrets privilege. The complaint filed on May 8th by a group of Maine citizens and the Maine Civil Liberties Union petitioned the Public Utility Commission to order Verizon to disclose whether it had released customer email and phone records to the NSA. The groups also asked the commission to find out if surveillance equipment had been installed in any Verizon facilities in the state. According to the Maine law, the commission is required to consider an investigation of any complaint against a utility company filed by 10 or more customers. The state service privilege allows the government to invoke a national security risk to avoid disclosing documents.
The Sierra Club is suing the Bush administration over new rules to boost gas mileage requirements for sport utility vehicles and pickup trucks. The group says the regulations do not go far enough. The Sierra Club joined 10 states and other environmental groups in challenging the rules. The regulations would raise gas mileage requirements by 1.8 million per gallon for the 2008-2011 model years to a fleet-wide average of 24 miles per gallon. The administration released the new rules in March. The program implements gas mileage rules based on the vehicle's size. It's expected to save more than 10 billion gallons of fuel burned in the life of the vehicles made during the 2008-2011 model years. However, detractors have said that only amounts to a few weeks of fuel.
Senators from both parties are blasting the Federal Trade Commission's report on gas prices following Hurricane Katrina. North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan says the oil companies get all the gain while consumers feel all the pain. Mississippi Senator Trent Lott says some of what happened is outrageous and indefensible. FTC Chairwoman Deborah Platt Majoris told a Senate committee today that the market was working according to laws of supply and demand. She defended the agency's finding that there was no widespread effort by the oil industry to manipulate the marketplace. Senator Barbara Boxer told Majoris, "I think you're on their side," meaning the oil industry. But Majoris fired back, saying there shouldn't be any doubt about her empathy for average Americans who are dealing with higher gas prices.
Senior executives at Fannie Mae manipulated accounting to collect millions of dollars in undeserved bonuses and to deceive investors, a federal report charged today. The government-sponsored mortgage company was fined $400 million. The blistering report by the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, the result of an extensive three-year investigation, was issued as Fannie Mae struggled to emerge from an $11 billion accounting scandal. Of the almost half-billion-dollar fine, the $350 million assessed by the SEC, one of the largest penalties ever in an accounting fraud case, will go to compensate Fannie Mae investors damaged by the alleged violations. The company also agreed to limit the growth of its multi-billion-dollar mortgage holdings, capping them at $727 billion, and to make top-to-bottom changes in its corporate culture, accounting procedures, and ways of managing risk. 30 executives and employees at the company, as well as others who have left, including the current president and CEO, will be reviewed for possible disciplinary action or termination. Fannie Mae admitted no wrongdoing in the settlements.
The Senate is poised to vote by the end of this week on its version of the controversial immigration reform bill. Last week, the Senate approved amendments to the bill to make English the national language, to build a 370-mile fence along the Mexican border, and to bar immigrants convicted of a felon or three misdemeanors, including evading and deportation order, for legalization. On Monday, hundreds of immigrants and advocates gathered at the California State Capitol to mark the 10th annual Immigrants Day, rallying in support of immigrant rights. Nock Nguyen was there and files this report.
An interfaith group kicked off the event, which drew multicultural and religious participants from across the state. 60-year-old Hua Chen is from San Jose. He traveled to Sacramento to tell state lawmakers to support legislation that helps immigrants better integrate into American society. He came to the United States about 7 years ago and recently earned his citizenship. With pride, he showed off his newly acquired language skills.
Today is an immigration day, So I come here to support on the act, the new Californian act that have a benefit for the immigrant.
Jen pointed to benefits such as health care, housing, and access to information about social services in his language. But an English-only amendment approved by the Senate last week can make it harder for individuals like Jen to access services and integrate into society. Appearing on a Sunday morning news show, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said the declaration of English as the national language is symbolic and would not undercut other federal and state laws that provide for language access.
Of course, English is the common unifying language of our great country. English represents a path to opportunity. I have consistently said that English represents freedom in our country. In order to be successful and take advantage of the wonderful opportunities in America, you need to be able to communicate in English.
The English-only amendment has drawn fire from immigrants and advocates who fear it will roll back language access efforts and even compromise national security. Sunil Ambagaukar is an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center.
It's a real harmful measure because things like really critical things like even in national security or disaster relief, if you take the Katrina example, FEMA would not be able to provide anything in other than English to announce evacuation procedures or even to, you know, get relief to people. And given our demographics and the changes, it's impossible to imagine how you would conduct a disaster relief operation without other languages provided.
Maria Reyes is with Mujeres Unidas y Activas, a community-based group that provides leadership training for women. She explains how lack of medical translators affected her personally.
Pues yo pienso que esta ley, de nuevo, volvemos a decir que es injusta, porque si estamos hablando de que...
So, and I personally have a case where I was in the hospital and I had to wait at the hospital for 16 hours. And it was in part because I had, I didn't speak very good English and there was no one at the hospital that spoke Spanish. So literally all day I just kept hearing, I'm really sorry, I don't speak Spanish, we're really sorry, we're really sorry.
While advocates like attorney Ambagaukar view language access as a civil right, others view it as a human right. Nam Thai is a Vietnamese-American social worker who attended the rally with her husband, Vicente Suarez, who is an electrician. The couple has two children who are on their way to becoming trilingual. Nam Thai came to the United States as a refugee in 1985.
We as immigrant refugees to this country need to, speak out for our rights, as our rights to belong, to live here, to work, to have a family, and to speak the language of our native land, because that's a part of our culture. I mean, you know, if you take that away from us, to me, that's like a cultural genocide. If you take our language away, I mean, I send my daughter to Vietnamese language school every Sunday, hoping that she can, you know, have that as part of her cultural heritage.
The couple says they believe the ability to speak another language besides English is an asset in an increasingly global economy and world. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Na Quinn in Sacramento.
The Senate today defeated an amendment submitted by California Senator Dianne Feinstein to allow all undocumented immigrants living in the United States to become legal residents. Feinstein's amendment would have removed the tiered system, which splits undocumented, undocumented immigrants into three groups. Several senators who would have had otherwise supported Feinstein's amendment voted against it to preserve the fragile coalition backing the larger immigration bill. The amendment failed 61-37. The Senate today also agreed to authorize the deployment of the National Guard to the U.S.-Mexico border. The entire bill is likely to receive a final vote later this week.
L.A.-based labor contractor Global Horizons owes nearly $300,000 in fines and unpaid wages for allegedly deceiving 88 agriculture workers from Thailand that it sent to Hawaii. U.S. Labor Department officials say the firm illegally deducted housing and food costs from the workers' wages and may not have paid for the workers' transportation. The company had brought those workers into the U.S. under a visa program that makes the firm responsible for those costs. A Labor Department spokesman says the company undercut workers' wages by having them approved to work in Arizona, where pay rates are lower than in Hawaii. Then they were allegedly sent to work in Hawaii and paid the Arizona wages. Global Horizons president Mordechia Orion says a former client in Hawaii is to blame for the underpayment. Thai workers were imported to Washington State last year during a labor conflict over apple harvest.
The current time is 5:25, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Gosh, George W. has kept us all so busy trying to deal with his disastrous Iraq war and with his buildup of a whole new war in Iran that I'd forgotten about his war in Afghanistan. How's that going? It's an important question since, unlike Iraq and Iran, the Taliban thugs who rule this country actually had direct ties to Osama bin Laden and the crash bombers who attacked us on 9/11. Our military quickly retaliated by bombing the bejesus out of the place, routing the Taliban, and installing our guy, Hamid Karzai, as the new president. That was that, right? Well, not exactly. Osama bin Forgotten is still out there somewhere in Afghanistan's mountain caves. Our man Karzai can't venture outside the protective bubble of his capital city. The economic revitalization that Bush promised was never delivered. Unemployment and poverty are rampant. And the Taliban is now resurgent. When the commander of U.S. forces traveled recently to the southern provinces, a shopkeeper told him what he did not want to hear. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda are everywhere. They're big in numbers, flush with money, brandishing weapons, and in control. Karzai and the Bushites are pinning their hopes on a new governor they've installed in the province, Malavi Munib. But he has problems. First, our previous governor there sold all of the province's police vehicles, guns, and ammunition. Second, he is a former high official in the Taliban government and remains on the United Nations wanted list. Karzai has now requested that the UN drop him from the list, but Russia opposes this. Meanwhile, the Bushites have announced that they'll soon withdraw U.S. troops from southern Afghanistan, a move that is emboldening the Taliban and weakening the public support for the U.S.-backed government. This is Jim Hightower saying, before Bush takes on another country, shouldn't he finish what he started in this one? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Out Loud, followed by Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Clemmie's Grooves. Expect warm showers in the Willamette Valley. For the rest of the week, highs around 70 in the Columbia Gorge. Rain today, but tomorrow there'll be more sunshine, then showers, highs near 70. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Osama bin Laden purportedly said in an audio tape Tuesday that Zakariya Moussaoui, the only person convicted in the U.S. for the September 11th attacks, had nothing to do with the operation. He had no connection at all with September 11th, the speaker, claiming to be bin Laden, said in the tape posted on the Internet. I am the one in charge of the 19 brothers, and I have never assigned Brother Zakariya to be with them in that mission, he said, referring to the 19 hijackers. The Al-Qaeda chief said the September 11th hijackers were divided into two groups, pilots and assistants. Since Zakariya Moussaoui was still learning how to fly, he wasn't number 20 in the group, as your government has claimed, bin Laden said. It knows this very well, he added. Bin Laden said Moussaoui was not a security risk for Al-Qaeda because he did not have knowledge of the plot. Bin Laden said Moussaoui's confession that he helped plan the attacks was void, calling it the result of pressures exercised against him during 4.5 years in U.S. prison.
The Israeli High Court of Justice today rejected an appeal by town residents to change the route of Israel's separation wall near Jerusalem. Manar Gibran reports.
The route of the wall is planned in a way that enables Israel to annex Palestinian lands between Ma'ali Adumim settlement block and the east of Jerusalem and isolates the Palestinian areas and blocks the geographical contiguity of the West Bank. On Monday, the Israeli High Court approved a section of the wall south of Qalqilya, north of the West Bank. The decision isolates 1,000 acres of Palestinian orchards behind the wall and includes the settlements of Beit Ariyeh and Ofarim. It will lead to the uprooting of 1,100 olive trees that belong to the Palestinian residents. Residents of the town of Al-Azariya today lost their appeal against the wall's path. The construction of the wall is viewed by many Palestinians as part of the unilateral measures Israel is taking to draw its final borders, diminishing any possibility of a Palestinian viable contiguous state. The International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled in July 2004 that the separation wall is illegal. Regardless, the Israeli government said it will accelerate the construction of the wall and complete 95% of its route within a year. For FSRN from IMMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
The House of Representatives passed legislation that places strict sanctions on the Hamas-led Palestinian government. On the daily, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert arrived in D.C. to meet with President Bush. Rhetoric from both supporters and opponents of the sanction legislation blamed Hamas for violence, but defended Israel's role in the court. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
By a vote of 361-37, the House passed the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act. It cuts all funding for the Palestinians and severely limits humanitarian aid. It also stops funding the portion the United Nations gives to the Palestinians on behalf of the United States. It prohibits U.S. businesses from doing business in parts of Gaza and the West Bank labeled terrorist sanctuaries, and it limits the travel of Palestinian officials and closes diplomatic offices. Democrat Tom Lantos from California, a Holocaust survivor and co-author of the bill, blamed Hamas for ongoing violence.
Our legislation will serve as a model for the right policy to take against terrorists, however they take power.
And labeled Israel as the victim.
And on behalf of a democratic ally that is the target of suicide bombings by a governmentally organized campaign.
Even opponents to the sanctions who say it will have a devastating effect on the Palestinian people praised Israel for her resilience and suffrage.
The refusal of the political leadership of Hamas to recognize the state of Israel, renounce violence and terrorism, and agree to previous agreements and obligations of the Palestinian Authority is unacceptable.
That was Democrat Betty McCollum from Minnesota. But protesters don't think Israel is innocent in the conflict between the two peoples. Rabbi Israel David Weiss from Nedaroy Karda International, or Jews United Against Zionism, is one of these people. He and fellow Orthodox followers held Palestinian flags and signs in support of Palestinian sovereignty. They believe the entire state of Israel should be given to the Palestinians, which is mandated by the Torah, he says.
It's just like propaganda. Always the Zionists try to put the fear factor in the Jewish people. You can't deal with the Muslims. You can't deal with the Arabs. They want to kill every Jew. They want to drive them into the sea. That's pure, blatant propaganda.
Hundreds of Jews traveled to D.C. to greet Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who is to meet with President Bush today and address Congress tomorrow. Of those who support the Prime Minister, some spat, pushed, and cursed at the Orthodox protesters.
So ashamed of yourself.
This is a handful of teenage girls ripping the protester signs into shreds. Meanwhile, a less severe version of the House sanctions bill is resting in the Senate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Hamid Karzai ordered an inquiry today into a U.S. bombing that killed at least 16 civilians, including some at religious schools, and called for a meeting that would with the commander of American forces in Afghanistan. It was the second time in 5 weeks that Karzai has complained about the civilian deaths from airstrikes by U.S.-led coalition. U.S. warplanes targeted the southern village overnight Sunday because Taliban fighters were hiding there, and dozens of the militants were killed. It was one of the deadliest U.S. attacks since the American-led invasion in 2001. Karzai expressed concern at the coalition forces' decision to bomb civilians in those areas in the Kandahar province, but he also strongly commended the terrorist act of cowardice in using civilians as human shields. Local officials said 17 civilians died in the bombings of an Islamic school and mud brick homes, and the U.S.-led coalition said at least 20 and perhaps as many as 80 militants were killed.
The Kingdom of Jordan has the highest rate of population growth in the Middle East, but is one of the poorest in terms of natural resources. Ministry of Water officials are already predicting that the country will suffer from water shortages this summer, but there is also a serious long-term problem. Jordan is one of the three countries that depends on water from the Jordan River Basin, which includes the Dead Sea. David Enders files this report from Amman.
In a nature reserve about 100 kilometers south of the capital, the Mujib River rushes through a narrow canyon and toward the Dead Sea, a popular tourist spot on the Israeli-Jordanian border that is being drained by both countries at a combined rate of 1 meter each year. However, the river only reaches the sea during Jordan's rainy winter, when it rises considerably. The rest of the time it is blocked by a dam, one of the many that interrupts the flow of rivers in the Jordan River Basin. The damming, combined with unsustainable water use and massive construction projects being funded both by Jordanians and by wealthy economies in the Persian Gulf, continues to threaten the country's water supply. The Royal Society for the Conservation of Nature, a Jordanian NGO founded in 1966 mostly on grants from USAID, is responsible for Mujib and about five other wildlife reserves in the country. The group is reintroducing wildlife such as ibex and ostriches that were nearly hunted to extinction in the last century, and also does education in Jordanian schools on water conservation. RSCN director Yahya Khalid also pointed out that the country is an important stop for migratory birds.
We worked with the Minister of Education to introduce the concepts of water conservation within the national curriculum. So we reviewed all the curriculum, Jordanian curriculum, and to see where are the gaps and which subjects. It might be in religion or math or physics or whatever, something like that. And we have that, after we identified that, we worked with them to introduce water conservation subjects and responsibility and what the students they can do within the national curriculum. These concepts have been now introduced and the books have been printed, and we trained the teachers on delivering these materials.
Jordan's population is nearing 7 million, and Yahya also put the blame for resource use on the influx of Iraqis, of whom as many as 1 million have fled to Jordan since the U.S. invasion 3 years ago.
And sometimes I hear in the news that in this summer that we'll have problem for water or shortage of water. I wonder, okay, as a Jordanian living in Jordan, have a shortage of water. Why Jordan is it trying to bring more people to live in Jordan? Because we can't cope with that. Maybe we should plan for that. I think that if we plan for that, and we do it well, that's excellent.
The World Bank has thrown its support behind a $3 billion project to dig a canal that would connect the Red Sea, which is another 200 kilometers to the south, to the Dead Sea. But Friends of the Middle East, an environmental group that has members in Israel, Jordan, and Palestine, says the project, locally referred to as the Red Dead Canal, does not address all of the concerns at hand, such as a new dam on the Yarmouk River, a tributary of the Jordan that is set for completion by the end of the year, and the growth of unsustainable crops for export, such as bananas and tomatoes. Mukhtar Mehyar is the chair of Friends of the Middle East in Amman.
We want the World Bank with the different respected ministries who's involved in this project in the three countries to look at the region as a whole, to look at other alternatives, to study the water situation in general, not only focusing on the level of the Dead Sea water, and that's it.
Other problems include the fact that the proposed canal site is in a fault zone and that sensitive ecological areas that receive a very specific amount of water each year might be damaged. In Amman, Jordan, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
India and Pakistan began talks on the disputed Sachin Glacier in New Delhi today. Located at an altitude of more than 15,000 feet above sea level, the glacier is considered the highest battlefield in the world. Shahzawan Khan has more.
Top defense officials from India and Pakistan began two-day talks in New Delhi Tuesday over the disputed Sachin Glacier located in Jammu and Kashmir. The Indian side is headed by Defense Secretary Shekhar Dutt, while as his counterpart Lieutenant General Tariq Husim Ghazi heads the Pakistani team. The two sides are likely to discuss possibilities of demilitarization of the world's highest battlefield, where harsh weather is a greater adversary than the enemy troops. Reports from New Delhi, quoting official sources, said the talks began in a positive atmosphere. An armored standoff began at Siachen in 1984. With forces deployed at elevations of up to 22,000 feet, more soldiers have died from the bitter cold then combat. Lieutenant General V.K. Batra is the defense spokesman in Srinagar.
It is a totally glacial area where there are no animals, no foliage or vegetation. The troops are living in total isolation at a height of ranging from 15 to 22,000 with a lot of snow. Round the year, the temperature in the extreme winters goes down to minus 60, and in the good summer season, it still remains below sub-zero.
Thousands of troops have died after succumbing to harsh conditions on the glacier since Siachen was militarized in 1984. Colonel Batra says the army is better equipped now than in the initial years. Harun Rashid, a journalist, works with Daily Asian Express in Srinagar.
At the onset of the occupation of the Siachen glacier, the death rate of troops from Indian side, according to the figures, was near about 1,500 per year. With the advancement of technology, more warmer clothing and other facilities, it has come down to near about 50 or 60.
The cost of maintaining troops at the glacial heights runs into millions.
Each day, India incurs a cost of $1.1 million per day only to maintain its troops at the site. And in turn, Pakistan maintains its troops at a little over $500,000 per day. Yeah, even America, it has, for America, it has not maintained troops at such places where there is cost of maintaining so high. Until now, if you get a cumulative amount of how much they have spent on the glacier, from mid-80s to until now, it is near about more than $15 billion. If that $15 billion could have been utilized in a proper way, entire poverty that is in India and Pakistan would have been eradicated with this amount.
Hopes of demilitarization of Siachen rose last year when Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh said he wanted to convert Siachen into a peace mountain. Analysts, however, say Defence Secretary Dutt and his counterpart Tariq Ghazi are unlikely to arrive at a decision soon, given the mistrust between India and Pakistan. India is insisting on demarcation of what it calls an actual ground position line, while Pakistan argues that such an exercise would legitimize Indian occupation in the area. And from India's vantage point, journalist Harun Rashid explains the country's bottom line concern.
If there is a demilitarization, and according to the military strategies of India, that they fear that Pakistan will reoccupy this Siachen glacier, then to retain that, reoccupy that glacier by Indian troops, it will cost India near about $1 billion plus lots of manpower.
How much the two countries move ahead on the issue will be clearer once the talks conclude Wednesday. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
Trawling databases to profile potential terror suspects is illegal except in specific cases of concrete danger. Germany's highest court ruled today in a victory for a Moroccan student. The student, whose name has not been made public, sued a German state after the September 11, 2001 attacks to stop it from mining university and government databases to identify Muslim students between the ages of 18 and 40. A top regional official said the decision by the Federal Constitutional Court would have little effect on security. The court said that the program had not identified any terrorist sleepers. The court ruled that random data trawling was legal only in the event of a specific danger rather than a broad, elevated threat. North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's most populous state, scanned data on more than 5 million men aged 18 to 40 after the September 11th attacks, although there were no firm evidence that any of the attacks were planned in the region.
The United Nations Refugee Agency has started the repatriation of thousands of Sudanese refugees, mostly from Uganda, following the end of a 21-year-long civil war in southern Sudan. So far, 27,000 of some 174,000 Sudanese refugees in Uganda have registered to repatriate. Over the weekend, about 200 Sudanese refugees, including women, elders, and young people, returned to their home in villages in southern Sudan. FSRN's Joshua Chalimpa joined the returning refugees on their journey back home.
It was a moving moment as the refugees finally left for home. Some of the returnees were children born in Uganda by refugee parents. The only stories that they know about Sudan are those that they have been told to them by their parents. For some refugees, it has been 21 years since they were in their home country. Last week, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees started a repatriation program to return refugees back to Sudan. Many are, however, not excited about returning because they are not sure if the peace will hold. And the only friends they have are those they have made in exile. 2-year-old Kwonye Lilian is one who will be left behind with her uncle, Nyora Emmanuel.
Why is the child remaining?
This child was remaining concerning about marriage issues. Her mother was getting married. So this child called me uncle. This is why he will remain, because her husband was ran away to Sudan. Because in our culture, if your daughter is get married, then give something.
What do you mean, something?
Just like if goats, if not goats, like money, like that.
So the father could not afford and he ran away?
Yeah.
Kwonye Lilian's mother, Jire Joyce, has to leave for Sudan, but family members believe she will reunite with the father of the child who has run back to Sudan after not being paid dowry. In the culture of the Kuku tribal group in Sudan, such a child can only meet the father after the dowry has been paid. Large-scale returnees became possible after the UNHCR finalized a tripartite agreement with Sudan and Uganda last month. Roberta Russo, UNHCR's external relations officer, says the organization is overstretched because they have received less than half of the $2.7 million budgeted for the exercise.
UNHCR has been appealing for money to repatriate refugees from different asylum countries. Uganda is the country of asylum with the biggest number of refugees, but still all the money that the donors have donated, and I would say that the donors reacted to our appeal, but of course we didn't get all the money that we needed, because a lot of money are needed, first of all, to rebuild infrastructures inside South Sudan and to start the process of demining. So of course the donors have donated money, but it's not enough.
The removal of the landmines is still a major concern, according to the band Silas Dima of the Mine Action Group, an organization working on removing landmines in the southern Sudan. There are still many landmines in the villages.
There are still high-risk areas that we have identified in Kajukeji, and even there are still cases of landmines being found, and accidents of animals is still going on. At the moment, at the way station, Mark as a mine advisory group, it's carrying out awareness so that it reduces the risk of getting accidents from the landmines and leftover weapons.
Despite the risks, many Sudanese are lining up to be repatriated to Sudan. An estimated 350,000 Sudanese fled to neighboring countries, and 4 million more were internally uprooted by civil war. Some of the anonymous Sudanese who talked to me at the Kangai transit camp at Kajokeji in southern Sudan through an interpreter were excited to be back home.
He feels that he is happy because he has moved away from the life of the refugee. He is now coming back home, so he is very happy.
She is going to start with what is the packages that she is going to get from here, and then after that she will begin to cultivate for herself. Her relatives have died all during the war, and others died in Khartoum, so she's just alone, and she's going to begin just alone.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kangai Wekam in Kajokeji, southern Sudan.
New scientific research on global temperatures indicates that future temperatures may rise much further than previously thought. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
These two new studies, one in the US and one in Europe, used historical records to assess the likely global warming rise. Their findings challenge the consensus view of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the global body which collates and analyses climate research.
They say current estimates are far too low, by as much as 78%. The research groups both sides of the Atlantic came up with similar findings. They've been conservative in their research, they say, but there'll be a likely temperature rise of about 5.8 to 7.7 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Environmentalists are now watching to see how this new research will impact on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's upcoming major study, and if these findings will impact on global policy to tackle climate change. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A top United Nations official is reporting that jailed pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi remains in good spirits and still wants to make a contribution to society. On Saturday, the official Ibrahim Gambari became the first foreigner to meet with Suu Kyi since she was put under house arrest in 2003. Suu Kyi leads the Burma's National League for Democracy. The group won a landslide election victory in 1990, but the military refused to hand over power. For the past 3 years, Suu Kyi has been held in near complete isolation from the outside world. Her phone has been cut off, and she is barred from having visitors except for a doctor and a maid. This week, the generals who crushed Suu Kyi's democracy movement are expected to decide whether to extend her house arrest beyond its present term, which expires on Saturday.
The local parliament of Spain's Canary Islands has requested military assistance to patrol surrounding waters. The request comes as large numbers of would-be migrants have been arriving in the Canary Islands by boat from Africa. An estimated 7,400 Africans have landed in the Canary Islands so far this year. A record-setting 647 migrants arrived on the island in one day last week. The spike in migration to the Canary Islands comes after Spain and Morocco begin heavy immigration enforcement activities along what used to be the most often traveled migration routes into the European mainland. Many of the boats landing in the Canary Islands set out from Senegal. Senegalese authorities say they have captured over 1,500 migrants at sea on their way to Europe since Thursday of last week. Spain today asked the European Union for logistical support.
That's the KVU Evening News for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kvu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on transmitter K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producers for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Rebus. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter, Leah Ann Krantz, and Eugene Johnson. Our engineer is Judy Feastable. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Josonia Watson.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m. here, Locust Focus Talk Radio with Barbara Bernstein, whose topics are Project Hope, Lenny D., and the Universal Healthcare Ballot Measure. Also, the implosion of the Trojan Cooling Tower and the future of nuclear power as an energy option. At 9 a.m., it's Movie Talk with Ed, DK, and Don on the latest films. At 9:30, on Speaking of Animals, hear an interview with Peter Singer, bioethics professor at Princeton. He's been called the father of the animal rights movement. He'll talk about his new book, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. At 10 a.m. on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with both Stephen Jones, physics professor at Brigham Young University, whose paper, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse?, documents that the official 9/11 story couldn't be true, and Michael Berger, spokesperson for the upcoming 9/11 Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming Our Future conference in Chicago, June the 2nd to the 4th. At 10:30, Robin Shanti speaks with David Corden, author of the best-selling When Corporations Rule the World. He'll discuss the ideas in his new book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 23rd of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Tempers are again flaring at a blockade near the Six Nations Reserve in Caledonia, Ontario. Members of the Six Nations Reserve have occupied a construction site slated for a housing project since February 28th, saying the land was taken from them in the 1840s. The group is asking the federal government to step in and resolve the issue, but that has been a slow process. Clan mothers from the reserve are currently in negotiations with the government. Catherine Montour is acting executive director of CKRZ Radio on the reserve. She says yesterday's tensions mounted after the group took down a blockade on the main street in Caledonia as a goodwill gesture to help with the talks.
We did that. However, the residents of Caledonia made their own blockade, a human chain, and they wouldn't let anyone through. So tensions rose from that, and they apparently surrounded a Native car with some elders in there and broke one of the windows of the vehicle and wouldn't let her through. So she was very scared, and the police got her out of there. But then the Natives on our side were very concerned about it, so they put another blockade up.
Montour says Caledonia residents became increasingly angry and tensions mounted to the point where the protesters then dug up the road with a backhoe. Police are trying to keep the two sides separate.
A few people hurt. There's been pepper spray sprayed at our side. Anger is very high right now there.
Montour says the dispute has brought awareness to the Six Nations land claims issue, but it's also brought members of the reserve together.
It's made people think about their heritage, their ancestors. It's a good thing on our side because we're realizing who we are, and it's time. I think it's time. We don't want to leave this situation for our children to look after. We need to deal with it now, and this is the generation that's going to do it.
Montour says they don't want violence and need to live amicably with their non-Aboriginal neighbors in Caledonia. Construction at the housing project is halted while negotiations continue. Updates and photos of the protest can be found on the CKRZ website, ckrz.com. Meanwhile, officials from a village in Wisconsin plan to contact descendants of a Potawatomi tribe to see if a parcel of land needs protection. The property is thought to contain Native burial sites from the early 1800s. Randall Davidson of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The village of Williams Bay is in far southeastern Wisconsin near the Illinois border. The site in question is a vacant lot along a village road. It's thought to be where the remains of two of the wives of Chief Bigfoot were laid to rest around 1836. Under tribal customs, the former Lake Geneva branch of the Potawatomi placed the remains on bark wooden platforms above the ground. The tribe then moved to Kansas, and the remains were discovered by the area's first white settler. In 1929, a plaque was installed to mark the site, but it was recently removed. Historical accounts indicate two children may also be buried at the site. Village Attorney Mark Schrader says some state records describe the property as a burial site, but it's not listed as such by the State Historical Society. Schrader says he'll be contacting tribal representatives in Forest County in northern Wisconsin to see whether they want to protect the site from development. I'm Randall Davidson.
The chairman of the Alaska Suicide Prevention Council says reconnection with traditions and avoidance of alcohol are keys to curbing self-inflicted deaths among Alaska Natives. William Martin, who's also a Tlingit Haida leader, testified last week at a U.S. Senate Indian Affairs hearing on the suicide rate among Native American youth.
As an Alaska Native leader, I have become convinced that my people must go back to the study of the lessons of our ancestors. They lived in a time before alcohol was introduced to our communities. Suicide then was an unheard of event, except in rare cases where one has grievously shamed his family or has caused despicable hurt upon others.
Martin also says Native adults need to communicate with and praise children to boost their self-esteem. He says some youth may think the only time they'll have nice things said is during the eulogies at their funerals. Martin also told the Senate Indian Affairs panel there's a serious need for federal and other funding for Native suicide prevention programs. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.